they asked me, do you know why you're here? And I said, well, I'm assuming it's over the car accident. And they said, no, we're investigating a rape case. And I immediately said, I don't know anything about no rape case. What are you talking about? You know, they took me into a room with a different detective who was doing the polygraph test. He asked me if I knew her name. I said, no. He asked me, did I rape her? I said, no. Yeah, he looked at me and said, Mr. Lowry, my test is showing me that you're lying. I said, lying? How am I lying? I go, I told you the truth about everything. And he walked out, got the two detectives. They came back in and got me and put me back into that interrogation room. And that's when things really went downhill. And finally, I just said, okay. What do you want to know? And they said, we want to know how you got in the house. They said, what'd you do after that? Didn't you get another knife or something or pick up something sharp? I said, yeah, I think I did. And then they said, what'd you do then? I said, I raped her. And they go, well, what'd you do after that? I said, I ran out to my car and I left.
Feeling lost?
Then you're in the right place.
I'm Amanda Knox.
And I'm Christopher Robinson.
And this
is False Confessions,
a Labyrinths miniseries.
The man you just heard is not a rapist. Eddie Lowry was 22 years old when he confessed to a crime he didn't commit. He was young. He was alone. He believed his innocence would save him. All factors that made him more likely to become compliant under pressure from law enforcement. We'll return to Eddie's story a bit later, but for now, we want to talk about you and all the factors that may put you at risk for falsely confessing.
No one thinks it can happen to them until it does. It may seem like an extremely unlikely nightmare, but false confessions are a lot more common than you may think. They are a contributing factor in 29% of wrongful convictions and 60% of wrongful convictions for homicide. Why would that number more than double?
As Saul Kassin explains in his book, Duped, homicide detectives are the all-stars of every police department. They gain fame and reputation and are promoted through their ability to close cases by confession. They are the chosen ones, singled out for special training. And far too often, this training is the Reed method, which we explored last episode.
And if you think you're safe because you're unlikely to end up accused of homicide, I certainly thought that, consider this. The same interrogation techniques used by homicide detectives are widely used, thanks in part to Reed and Associates, by the military, in schools, and in workplace loss prevention departments. This is extremely troubling because such situations do not require Miranda rights, recording of custodial interrogations, or any of the other legal safeguards that advocates have fought for to protect innocent people from police coercion.
We begin with perhaps the most obvious and common risk factor, youth.
I was 22 years old.
I was just a little over 24 years of age.
I was 22 years old.
I was 20. Johnny Hincapier, who you heard in episode 1, was 18. That's not a coincidence. Remember that 29% number? Well, false confessions play a role in 42% for wrongful convictions where the suspect is a youth.
Essentially, youthful suspects are people who are under the age of 18, and then there's another category between 18 and 24 or 25 that we call emerging adults. Both youthful suspects and emerging adults function differently than many adults in the interrogation room.
Steve Drizin, director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions.
And a lot of it has to do with psychosocial immaturity, and some of it has to do with brain science that demonstrates that the areas of the brain of a suspect, the prefrontal cortex, which is sort of right behind your forehead, that is the executive center of the brain. That is the part of the brain that is involved in assessing risk, making good judgments in sort of inhibiting the rash parts of your brain, the fear or flight impulses that are generated from the midbrain. And in your teenage years, a lot of your actions and activities are impulsive, right? It's sort of how we grow up. We take risks, we learn from those mistakes, and then we don't make them again, right? And so the interrogation process really targets the decision-making capacities of young people. Their desire to get out of the interrogation room at all costs is really about focusing on short-term rewards without looking at the long-term consequences of their actions. So that's why we see young people being overrepresented in data sets of false confessions. So what I'm trying to say is the tactics that we've been talking about, they land much more heavily on young people. Things that may not be deemed coercive with adults are coercive when applied to young people.
Can you give an example of that?
If you suggest to a suspect that help will be on the way, or that, you know, they want to just get through this process so you can see your family members, or that you might go home, they're going to grab onto that. And that's going to become the primary motivating force for them to confess. There's also this layer of deference to authority, right? Police officers are officer friendly. Even if they're not, in many neighborhoods, inner city neighborhoods, suspects are taught not to push back against officers, to comply, because it could end up costing you your life, right?
Even Reed and Associates acknowledges the danger here. In one training video, President John Buckley says,
"The investigator should also exercise cautions when interviewing socially immature juveniles. And with these subjects, we do not lie to them about evidence in the case."
Perhaps the most striking case of the vulnerability of youth to coercive interrogation tactics is that of the Central Park Five.
On the morning of April 20th, 1989, New York City awakened to the horrifying news.
A Wall Street investment bank left for dead after a brutal attack while she was jogging in Central Park.
A female jogger was clinging to life after being beaten and sexually assaulted in Central Park. The city was outraged. The police quickly arrested a group of teenagers. Their trial gripped the city.
The five boys accused of raping jogger Trisha Mailey and leaving her for dead had all confessed. Their confessions were detailed. They corroborated each other, and four of the five were recorded in front of their own parents. Here's what Corey Wise told detectives.
"This is my first rape. This, I never did this before in the schoolroom, my last time doing it."
It was an obvious case of guilt, and even Saul Kassin was shocked in 2002 at the news that a man named Matias Reyes had come forward to confess to the crime, and that his DNA was a match for the semen found on Maley's clothes. Semen which had long ago been tested to exclude the Central Park Five. The rape also fit Reyes' M.O. During that very summer, he'd raped four women and killed one, even tying one of them up in a manner strikingly similar to how Trisha Mailey had been tied up. Her t-shirt wrapped behind her head, crisscrossed through her mouth, then used to tie her hands in front of her face.
Matias Reyes was clearly the sole attacker. And as the Central Park Five's convictions were vacated, that left a lingering mystery. How could five boys all confess to a crime they didn't commit? A big contributing factor was their age. Corey Wise was 16. Anton McRae and Yusuf Salam were 15. And Kevin Richardson and Raymond Santana were only 14 years old. All the techniques we've discussed in this series were used on these boys. They were given the third degree. Yusuf Salam said he could hear them beating up Corey Wise in the next room. "They would come and look at me and say, 'You realize you're next.'"
They were isolated. They were questioned late into the night for many hours. Their protestations of innocence repeatedly refused. They were lied to. Detective Tom McKenna told Yusuf Salam that they'd found his fingerprints on the victim's clothes.
And most crucially, they were pitted against each other.
Hardigan sat down and he said, "Look, Ray, I know you didn't do anything wrong, but the other guys right now, they're in other precincts and they're saying that you did it." And I'm like, "I didn't do anything." And he's like, "Well, this is why I'm here to help you, because I know you didn't do anything. You were a good kid. You know, this isn't you." He pulls out this picture of Kevin Richardson and he goes, "You know this kid?" And I'm like, "No, I don't know him." And he goes, "You see the scratch under his eye? That came from the woman. We know he did it. He's going down."
Imagine how destabilizing it would be to your sense of reality to learn that someone you trusted as a friend would name you as the perpetrator of a serious crime. That's how I felt when I was told that Raffaele had retracted my alibi.
My mind just felt like scrambled eggs. I really didn't know what was going on. I just wanted to get the hell home.
They were presented a theme that minimized their involvement, each being led to confess to being a witness or accomplice in the assault, but not the central perpetrator. Here's documentarian Ken Burns.
All of the cops were giving them what they thought was this out, where if you just say it's another person, we'll let you go home. But of course, by saying it was another person, it made you present and implicated you in the crime.
None of the five admitted to raping Maley, but merely restraining her or groping her while others carried out the rape. That minimization implied leniency, which explains why they all assumed they'd be going home after their interrogations. There's a subtle distinction here between a coerced false confession and a coerced false admission. But the result is often the same. I was coerced into a false admission of witnessing someone else carry out the murder, which ended up placing me at the scene of the crime and made me culpable as well. The very same thing happened with the Central Park Five. But in my case, beyond the murder charge, I was also convicted of criminal slander for the false admission I was coerced into signing, a charge I'm still fighting 17 years later.
That reminds me of your case and the Patrick Lumumba angle, because police had a theory that found their way into your statement, and you did what you see in dozens of games. Can you imagine in the Central Park Five, if each one of the five was charged with slander for implicating the others?
Mm-hmm.
The Norfolk Four, the Englewood Four, I mean, we could go on and on, Beatrice Six, they all implicated each other because they're under so much pressure that they implicate themselves. So of course, they'll implicate whoever you tell me to implicate.
And all of these interrogation techniques had a greater effect on the Central Park Five because of how young they were at the time.
That vulnerability and tendency toward compliance with authority is only increased when a suspect is developmentally disabled.
Among so many other people, I represent Brendan Dassey, who was a 16-year-old sophomore in high school, special education student in Wisconsin, when he confessed to a brutal rape and murder that he did not commit.
That's Laura Nyreiter, former co-director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions of Youth. Along with Steve Drizin, she's been representing Brendan Dassey of Making a Murderer fame for the last 15 years.
Why is he agreeing to go along with this grotesque story that they've imagined for him? 16, he's in 10th grade, he's in the cafeteria eating with his friends. They show up unannounced. His mom doesn't know that they're coming to talk to him, right? Principal comes and taps him on the shoulder. "Hey, can you come down to the office?" And all of a sudden, out of the blue, boom, Brendan is by himself with two adult seasoned detectives, right? Brendan has special needs. He's got learning disabilities. His IQ is right around 70, right? A lot of his disabilities center around the way he processes speech and his communication abilities. He can get really overwhelmed with an onslaught of words, which is exactly, as you know, what an interrogation is, right? And so they bring him into the principal's office and they subject him to this barrage of questioning about this murder, and we know you were there. And that's where it all starts. They don't know he was there. There is no evidence, zero evidence at this time implicating Brendan. 4 months earlier, this is back in 2006, about 4 months before the police came knocking on his door, they had arrested his uncle, a man named Stephen Avery, and accused his uncle of killing a young woman in the area, northern Wisconsin, who had recently gone missing, a young woman named Teresa Halbach. And they'd arrested Stephen Avery, and there was huge fanfare, a lot of media around this. But police had a lot of gaps in their narrative as they investigated this crime, and they were trying to build their case against Stephen Avery. They didn't really have a story of what had happened. And so they began coming to people around Stephen, people who knew him, right? Family members, fiancés, and his nephew, Brendan, finally, was one of the people on their list that they started talking to. They spoke to Brendan at school. Mm. Actually, they had 4 interrogations over 48 hours. The first one was at school, and then it devolved from there to interrogations at police stations. And he ended up confessing on videotape. So you can see the process by which this 16-year-old special education student, one of the most vulnerable people in the world, but also, I will say, one of the most kind and good-hearted and gentle people in the world, you can literally watch him being confused and manipulated and frightened into confessing to the worst crime imaginable and helping, he says, his uncle do it, right? So this is the heart of the evidence against Brendan Dassey, this confession that he gives on videotape to helping his uncle rape and murder Teresa Halbach. But there are huge problems with this interrogation from jump, right? I mean, Brendan is totally at sea during huge chunks of this narrative. They're asking him to describe these truly unimaginable acts, right? And he can't come up with the details. He doesn't know, for example, how this young woman was killed. The forensic evidence, they located her remains. The crime lab determined that she had been shot in the head. That's how she was killed. But when they asked Brendan on this tape, how did you murder this woman? He goes through everything that a 16-year-old kid can imagine. He's like, did we choke her? No, Brendan. What else did you do? Did we, you know, stab her? No, Brendan. What else did you do? Did we cut her throat? No, Brendan. What else did we do? It's like this guessing game until he gives up and he says, that's all I can think of. He still hasn't gotten it right. And they have to say to him, come on, Brendan, who shot her in the head? Right. I mean, it's just like this grotesque punchline that's dropped and he adopts it. And he's like, oh, that was my uncle, Stephen. And boom, all of a sudden, right, he places himself at the scene of this horrific murder. So from jump there, and that's just one example. There's so many other examples of this interrogation where they're asking him details of the crime that they believe to be true. He can't come up with them. And then they feed it to him over and over and over. So from day one, there were enormous problems with this confession. And this is back in 2006, right? And here's why I'm so glad you were doing this podcast series. In 2006, so little was known about the way police interrogation works, about false confessions. So counterintuitive to any ordinary person that anyone would confess to something they didn't commit. So Brendan was kind of without a shot because this is such a little known phenomenon. People said to themselves, this kid confessed, he must have done it. Isn't that weird that he couldn't describe any of it? We don't really know what to make of that. But he must be guilty. He must be a murderer. He must be a monster. And he was sentenced to life in prison on the basis of this confession to murder where he couldn't even describe how the murder happened. And that's where he still is to this day. And frankly, a whole host of people around the globe understand what happened to him, understand his confession is false. And none of us are going to stop until Brendan walks out of those prison doors.
One thing you'll notice about all these cases is that the person coerced into a false confession is so often alone, without any support system. Isolation is one of the key risk factors for false confessions. And unlike your age or IQ, this one is often actively created by the police.
We're talking about a room with a few chairs. If there's a table, generally we're talking about the table being pushed to the side or the table not being a barrier to how close the interrogator could get to you. There are no clocks supposed to be on the wall so that the isolated person doesn't have a sense of time, which is disorienting. Typically, the interrogator places themselves between the suspect and the door. So for the suspect to actually want to get up and leave, he's got to go through the interrogator or interrogators, because there's usually more than one. So the surroundings sort of reinforce this sense of isolation and dependence that the suspect has on his or her interrogator.
But isolation is more complex than just the room you're in. I was interrogated while I was studying abroad in a foreign country, 6,000 miles from home. The culture and even the language, which I spoke about as well as a 10-year-old, was a form of isolation. I often didn't understand what was being asked of me, and I assumed that their unwillingness to believe me was the fault of my own inadequate Italian. Without my family, my only support system was Raffaele, the boy I'd been dating for just a week. But then he was being pitted against me in his own interrogation. So the police became my only support system. They were the authorities I'd been raised to trust and who I was depending on to keep me safe. Little did I know that they had tapped my phone and knew that my mom was flying to Italy to help me through this difficult time. Once she arrived, I'd no longer be isolated. And so mere hours from her arrival, they brought me in for that final interrogation in which they broke me.
Perhaps the most surprising factor that puts an innocent person at risk of confessing to a crime they didn't commit is their innocence. Here's Professor Saul Kasson.
When I'm involved in these cases, I always ask the confessor a couple of questions. Why did you finally confess? And second, why didn't you just get a lawyer? And the why didn't you just get a lawyer answers that I get are always almost word for word the same. Well, I didn't need a lawyer. I didn't do anything wrong. You know, the vast majority of people waive their Miranda rights. If you compare innocent and guilty people, as we often do in lab studies, it's not even close. Innocent people waive their rights. They have no fear. They have nothing to hide. In fact, they think they will be exculpated by having a conversation. They become very complacent that their innocence will shine through. There's a naivety about this. People in general have, some more than others, a belief that things will work themselves out, a belief in a just world. And in addition, we tend to have this, what social psychologists have called an illusion of transparency. We think that when we tell the truth, it's obvious to others. And when we lie, it's obvious to others. And so for a variety of reasons, people believe that their innocence will shine through and they have nothing to lose. If you ask them, would you be willing to take a lie detector test? They say, sure. I can't tell you how many false confessors agreed to take a lie detector test before they were lied to about the results of that test. Then there's laboratory studies showing that when you make an accusation in the lab to guilty or innocent people who have or have not cheated on, for example, those who are innocent don't show the same level of physiological arousal in response to the accusation. They think it's going to work itself out. Now, all of that, I get it. What came together for me in one case and then subsequent cases that I saw changed the questions I asked is, you fought it for hours. Why did you finally break down? And here's what this person told me. He said, well, they told me they had blood evidence in the car and they were going to send it off to the lab. Well, I knew it wasn't going to be mine. I knew it wasn't mine. So I figured, okay, where do I sign? He'd been interrogated for hours. He wanted to get out of there. When they bluffed and said, we have evidence to send to the lab, in his mind, that bluff was a promise of future exoneration. I have since asked that question of others, and so many have said the same thing. In the back of my mind, I figured, you know what? This is going to work itself out. I need to stop this now. And in the meantime, this will work itself out. Amanda, in your case, you were shocked by what followed. As this is always the case, innocent people don't understand what's about to happen. They don't understand that the confession will unleash a chain of events that will make it nearly impossible not to be convicted of a crime.
There's one more factor we'd be remiss not to mention. Race. Marginalized populations are overrepresented in wrongful convictions data. According to the National Registry of Exonerations, of 3,200 defendants who were convicted of crimes in the United States and later exonerated because they were innocent, 53% of them were Black, nearly four times their proportion of the population. This isn't a factor that makes you more vulnerable to the interrogation techniques we've explored in this series, but one that makes you more likely to end up in the interrogation room to begin with. Once an interrogation begins, the primary goal of the interrogators is compliance. They've already decided you're guilty, and they simply need you to agree with them. As the Reed Manual explains, the strategy is to increase the stress associated with denial and reduce the stress associated with confession.
I'm alone in this room. I'm without friends. I'm without family. I'm without a lawyer. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. Nothing I seem to say works. They're insisting that I sign some paper. And when the process launches into, look, I think you're a good person. I understand where you're coming from. You know, in the case of Brendan Dassey again, who's still in prison, the investigator, the detectives literally said, Brandon, it's not your fault. Well, if it's not your fault, then you don't expect you're going to go to prison for signing their statement. And so these tactics in which promises are not made openly and explicitly, but they're implied to anybody who's listening. And in the laboratory, we find that those tactics not only are implied, but they get innocent college students to confess to cheating as a violation of the University Honor Code. Because they're kind of led to believe it's no big deal.
Yeah.
And I fear that It's those twin pillars. You break people down with the lies, and then lying about the consequences of confession finally gets them to put pen to paper.
While research on false confessions only goes back a few decades, there is psychological research on obedience to authority that is highly relevant here. Most notably, the work of psychologist Stanley Milgram in the early 1960s.
As a young professor at Yale, Milgram wanted to understand how and why people became complicit, specifically in violence. This question was spurred by the atrocity of the Holocaust, wherein many Nazis had claimed they were just following orders. So, as Adolf Eichmann stood trial in Jerusalem for war crimes, Milgram devised an experiment to understand just how obedient we are to authority.
The Milgram experiment, published in 1963, still stands as one of the most significant and controversial psychology studies ever conducted. It involved 40 men and two actors. One actor played the experimenter. Dressed in a gray lab coat, he told the subjects the experiment was designed to test the effects of punishment on learning. To do so, the subjects were instructed to shock Mr. Wallace, the other actor, every time he failed to answer a series of multiple-choice questions correctly. As Mr. Wallace completed the test, the subjects sat in front of a machine with 30 switches that increased from a slight shock to 450 volts labeled XXX. They were misled to believe that the machine was connected to the electrodes on Mr. Wallace's hands.
Now, if he gives the correct answer, you say correct and go on to the next line. The correct answer is underlined and is also indicated in the right margin.
Yeah.
If he were to indicate the wrong answer, you would say wrong. Then tell him the number of volts you're going to give him. Then give him the punishment. Then read the correct word pair once. And then go on to the next line. For example, if he indicated 3 for blue, you would say wrong. 15 volts. Depress and release the switch. Read blue girl. And then go on to the next line.
As the shocks became more painful, the subjects would notice signs of distress from Mr. Wallace, even asking the experimenter to make sure he was okay, but they were coaxed into continuing.
Incorrect. You'll now get a shock of 75 volts.
Oh.
Soft hair. He kind of did some yelling in there. Incorrect. You'll now get a shock of 105 volts. Hard hit. Just how far can you go in this thing?
As far as is necessary.
Many subjects continued delivering shocks as the voltage level neared the maximum of 450.
Let me out of here. You have no right to keep me here. Let me out. Let me out of here. Let me out.
Continue, please.
Let me out of here. My eyes bother me. Let me out. Let me out.
Responsible for it. Red. That is incorrect. This will be at 330.
Ow!
The correct phrase is rich.
Let me out of
boy.
Here. Let me out of here. My eyes bother me. Let me out, I tell you. Let me out of here. Let me out of here.
Even after Mr. Wallace expressed concerns regarding his heart condition, a majority of subjects continued delivering shocks.
About 2 years ago, I was at the Veterans Hospital in West Haven.
Mm-hmm.
And while there, they detected a heart condition. There's nothing serious, but as long as I'm having these shocks, how strong are they? How dangerous are they?
The experimenter's verbal prods to the subjects escalated over time, the final one being, "You have no other choice. You must go on." Some subjects even continued to punish Mr. Wallace after he appeared unresponsive.
Fast. Bird. Car. Train. Plane.
Go on, please, with the procedure.
Please answer. The answer is bird. 345 volts. Blunt. Knife. Stick. Word. Arrow. Answer, please. The answer is arrow. 360 volts.
By the end of the experiment, 26 subjects out of 40 believed they had delivered 450 volts to Mr. Wallace, sometimes more than once.
Woman, soldier, dog, horse. Answer is woman. 450 volts. That's it.
Now continue using the last switch on the board, please, the 450 switch for each wrong answer.
The experimenters had estimated that 1 out of 1,000 subjects would reach 450 volts, and they were shocked to find that 65% of subjects were able to be coaxed to that level, even after hearing Mr. Wallace's cries for help. The average subject delivered 27 out of 30 possible shock voltage levels. The experimenter's expectation wasn't unreasonable, given that they were only offering subjects $4.50 in reward money, worth about $45 today, and that the experimenters could not punish the subjects for leaving the experiment.
The results, as I observe them in the laboratory, are disturbing. They raise the possibility that human nature cannot be counted on to insulate men from brutality and inhumane treatment at the direction of malevolent authority. A substantial proportion of people do what they are told to do, irrespective of the content of the act and without limitations of conscience, so long as they perceive that the command comes from a legitimate authority. If in this study, an anonymous experimenter could successfully command adults to subdue a 50-year-old man and force on him painful electric shocks against his protests, one can only wonder what government, with its vastly greater authority and prestige, can command of its subjects.
Which brings us back to the interrogation room. As Saul Kassin points out in his book, Duped, there are many parallels between Milgram's experiment and an American-style interrogation. In both, subjects are isolated, away from their social support network. They are confronted with an authority figure, and they make a contractual arrangement to participate, i.e., signing a Miranda waiver before questioning, which many innocent people don't hesitate to do.
Both scenarios employ deception, and in both, the authority figure makes unwavering and relentless demands, and both use gradual escalation to achieve full obedience. Milgram wrote 4 prompts of increasing severity, and the Reed technique advises interrogators to first get the suspect to place themselves at the scene, then to admit to being an accomplice, then to being a major participant, and finally to fully admit to the crime. This pattern of escalation was evident in the questioning of the Central Park Five.
One of the major differences between these two scenarios is that institutional review boards in the behavioral sciences no longer permit the kinds of experiments Milgram conducted in the 1960s due to ethical concerns. It's a lot safer to participate in a psychology research study today than 60 years ago. U.S. courts, by contrast, don't protect criminal suspects to nearly the same degree. The case of Eddie Lowery is a classic example of a compliant false confession, one in which deference and obedience to authority played a pivotal role.
In 1981, I was 22 years old. I was in the United States Army, serving at Fort Riley, Kansas. I was a driver of a tank. I was an E-4 at the time. E-4 is right under a sergeant. I was living off post. I was married. And my wife was out in Ogden, Kansas, is where this happened at. And I would just get up in the morning, drive to the base, and do my military duties, and then come home at night.
So on this particular day, what happened?
Well, this happened over a weekend. And my wife and my child, who was 3 years old at the time, went back home to California to visit her parents. And I was having some buddies over, turned into a party. I decided to go down to the liquor store and get some cigarettes. So I jumped in my car. I went to the liquor store, got the cigarettes. Coming back home, there was another party going on across the street from where I was at. And somebody had their car parked halfway on the street and halfway on the shoulder. Mm. And I don't know if I was looking down or what happened, but I clipped the back of that car and I pulled over in front of it and stopped. I guess he was pretty upset that I hit his car because I guess it was new. The police were called and they showed up 15 minutes later or something and asked me if I'd been drinking. I said, well, I had a few beers, you know. So he did a sobriety test with me. I passed that and he told me, do I have anybody that can help me get my car back? Just at that time, two guys came riding up on a motorcycle that were at my party. They were GIs. They saw that it was my car. They stopped. And they helped me get my car back over to my trailer. Nothing was out of the ordinary. You know, I spent my Sunday doing whatever, you know. During my accident, I did hit the car hard enough that I didn't have a seatbelt on and I cut my chin on my steering wheel. So I was bleeding from my chin onto my clothes. This girl that was at the trailer, she butterflied stitched my chin up. So I didn't go to the hospital or anything. Finished out the Sunday, got up Monday morning, went to work on post. Came back home that evening, and there was a message for me to call the Riley County Police Department. I thought it was a car accident. You know, I was going to have to give a report and everything because I don't remember signing anything that night, you know, with the police officer that showed up at the accident. I also told the detectives that I couldn't drive my car, so they said they would come down and pick me up.
Okay. So they came down, picked you up. Did they say anything to you while you were still at the house?
No. I just walked to the front door and they put me in the car and they didn't handcuff me or anything. Just took me to the police station and put me into they would call it an interview room, but I called it an interrogation room.
Okay. So what you can say is that from their demeanor and what they were saying to you in the car, it seemed like this was no big deal.
Correct. I just assumed it was over the car accident, and that's what I was assuming all the way there.
Unbeknownst to Eddie, the Reed technique was already in full effect. The officers had already isolated him, both in the squad car and the interrogation room, depriving him of any support systems and making him more vulnerable to manipulation.
So they bring you into this room. Can you describe the room for me?
Yeah, it was a small a small room. When you walk into the door, I went to the left behind a 6-foot table, and my back was against the wall. The table was in front of me, and they stood in front of the table in front of me. I think there might have been a window on the door. There was no other than that. There was no other windows in there. No clocks, no fountain to drink water out of. It was a pretty bare room, white walls.
So how long were you in that interrogation room?
Well, the first day, that day, I was in there for maybe 2 to 3 hours. And that's when they told me, you know, why I was there, because they asked me, do you know why you're here? And I said, well, I'm assuming it's over the car accident. And they said, no, we're investigating a rape case. And I immediately said, I don't know anything about no rape case. What are you talking about? You know, they started going into details about what I was doing that night. And I kept on denying the crime. I said, I didn't do anything. I wasn't there. Over and over, repeatedly, I said, I went to the liquor store. I came back. I got in a car accident. I did a sobriety test. A police officer let me go. I pushed my car back to my trailer. That was my night, you know, besides having the party at my house earlier and stuff, you know. That's pretty much the whole thing. I was just repeating the whole thing over and over. It wasn't much to say. I just went to go get a pack of cigarettes, hit a car, and I was released and went home. When those hours were up and they said, okay, we're going to, you know, they were going to let me go back home, and they were going to take me home, they asked if they could search my car and if they could search my house. And I said, sure, I ain't got nothing to hide. Go ahead. You know, on the way home, one of the detectives told me that the other detective thought I was involved with this crime. And I'm like sitting in the car going, well, I wasn't involved with this crime. I don't know anything about this. And when I got home, they searched my car. They took a knife out of the back because, you know, I fished a lot in the out there. So I had a fishing tackle box. I had a knife sitting out and everything in the back of the car. They took that. They went in and asked me where my clothes were at that I wore that night. So I told them they were in the washing machine, but they hadn't been washed yet. So they went in and got my shirt and my pants, which had blood on it from my chin. And they bagged that up. And those were the only two items that I recall at the time that they took. They picked me up the next morning around 8 a.m. Took me back. Once I got there, they put me back in that same room again.
The initial isolation and questioning wasn't confrontational. Following Reed, it was a behavioral analysis interview meant to build rapport and to determine whether Eddie was concealing guilty knowledge. But when he returned to that room, the tenor had changed.
Well, you know, they kept on saying, well, we think you were involved. When they told me that it was an elderly woman that had been raped, you know, I stood my ground. I kept telling them, I don't know any older woman or elderly woman, and I didn't do this crime. I don't have any information to give you.
Following Reed, they refused to hear Eddie's claims of innocence.
Maybe an hour or so went by, and then they asked me if I would take a polygraph test. And I said, yeah, I'll take a polygraph test because I have nothing to hide. No, I thought polygraph tests actually worked. They took me into a room with a different detective who was doing the polygraph test, and they sat me in this room, just me and him. The other two detectives left, and he asked me to lie. He was doing a check on the polygraph test, see, you know, what kind of reading would get. Give me a fake name and a fake age. So I said something like David, and I'm 42.
You'll recall Saul Kasson noting that polygraph experts will often use deception, even at this stage, just to convince the suspect that the polygraph is infallible.
And they began asking me questions about this rape, you know, this lady's name. He asked me if I knew her name. I said, no. He asked me, did I rape her? I said, no.
Okay. So how long did the polygraph test last?
At least 45 minutes to an hour. You know, it seemed like I was in there for a long time. And I was answering no to a lot of the stuff he was asking me about the crime. I denied everything that had to do with this crime.
So you conclude the polygraph, and does the polygraph tester say anything to you?
Yeah, he looked at me and said, Mr. Lowry, my test is showing me that you're lying. I said, lying? How am I lying? I go, I told you the truth about everything. He goes, well, The test says you're lying. He goes, listen, if you tell me the truth right now and, you know, admit that you did this, I'll talk to the two detectives and they'll go easy on you. And I said, look, I go, I didn't commit this crime. I don't know what you're talking about. I've told you the truth about everything and I'm innocent. There's nothing I can tell you. He goes, I'm going to give you one more chance. Come clean with me and I can help you. And I kept telling him, I didn't commit this crime. I'm innocent. I had no involvement with this. He goes, all right, that was your last chance. And he walked out, got the two detectives. They came back in and got me and put me back into that interrogation room. And that's when things really went downhill. Well, they put me back in that room and I was behind that desk. And then the other detective was putting his finger in my face telling me, I know you committed this crime. We're going to find you guilty of this crime. If we had the death penalty and she had died, we'd be asking the death penalty on you and telling me what a horrible person I was, what a monster I was for committing this crime, and that I needed to come clean and confess to this crime. He was bringing up things about my sister being raped, my brother being killed, and just stuff that was really affecting me emotionally, besides being accused of this crime and being told I failed a polygraph test. It was just so much on me that, you know, I didn't know what to do.
It's worth noting here that the officers interrogating Eddie Lowery were going beyond what is officially advised by contemporary Reed technique manuals.
The investigator should not make any promises of leniency, threats of harm, or threats of inevitable consequences, or in any way physically abuse the subject, all of which many of the courts will view as coercive elements. The investigator should not conduct interrogations for an excessively lengthy period of time.
That's Joseph Buckley, president of Reed & Associates, and he seems to be against such methods, largely because the courts won't accept confessions obtained in such a manner. Regardless, such lengthy interrogations and innuendos of threat and leniency remain common in American interrogations. A recent analysis showed that 34% of interrogations that resulted in proven false confessions lasted 6 to 12 hours. 39% lasted 12 to 24 hours, and the mean was 16.3 hours.
And this went on for about 7 hours. I didn't get no water. I didn't get no breaks. I didn't get no food. And I'm just sitting there taking all this abuse from them. And I'm telling them I didn't commit this crime until they had me just so broken down. I had my arms folded on the desk and my forehead was on my arms and I'm crying and I'm trying to tell them I didn't do this. And it, you know, I didn't know what else to do. I was just lost. I mean, it's so hard to express in words the, you know, what I was going through during that interrogation, that it's hard to express to somebody the, you know, it wasn't that, oh, okay, well, I just commit, I know, and gave a confession. It was, I was just torn up. I was crying, man. I mean, I was just devastated and so alone and afraid.
Now that the police had isolated and confronted Eddie, presented him with false evidence of his guilt, and stressed their sincerity in wanting to help him, they turned to minimizing the crime to coax a confession.
In Eddie's case, officers introduced the psychological theme that Eddie may have been mentally unstable and was therefore less culpable.
One of the detectives was saying, Mr. Lowery, look, I think we know that you committed this crime, and if you come clean with us and you help us, I can get you help. I can get you counseling. We can talk to the judge. We'll get you a lighter sentence. And we'll just make this easy for you. And again, you know, I'm denying everything. I'm telling him I didn't commit this crime. There's nothing I can tell you. And then he would get tired. When it came down to the full confession, I just got... Like I said, I had my arms crossed on the table, my forehead's on my arms, and I don't even know how I just even started saying this, because in my head, I'm thinking, don't say anything, don't say anything, don't say anything. Oh, and before all this happened, I asked for a lawyer. So then they told me I didn't need a lawyer because I wasn't under arrest. So they denied my lawyer, and I said, well, I need to call my company commander. And they refused to let me call my company commander. I said, well, let me call my mom and dad. They refused to let me call my mom and dad. That's why I felt stuck, because they denied all these rights that I'm supposed to have and made me feel like I had to sit there in this room and take this abuse from them. It wasn't physical abuse, it was just really mental abuse. And so they had broken me down over the 7 hours, you know, and I'm just crying and stuff. And finally I just said, okay, what do you want to know?
There's another factor that made Eddie more vulnerable to this pressure to comply: his military background.
I've heard people tell me this before, that being in the military can actually make you more susceptible to a false confession, because you are trained from the very beginning of your military career to take and obey orders from authority figures. Does that like resonate with you in any way?
It does make sense to me, you know, because we are trained to take orders and follow commands. And these guys were authority figures over me.
After hours of psychological pressure from these authorities, Eddie had become fully compliant. He was willing to say anything to get out of that room, trusting that the actual evidence would prove his innocence. It's here where you can see echoes of Stanley Milgram's experiments on obedience.
And they said, we want to know how you got in the house. And I didn't know how this guy got in the house, man. I just thought of a John Wayne Western movie. I said, well, I went up to the front door and I just kicked it open. And they said, well, actually, didn't you go around back and pop the back door open and with a knife and get in that way? You cut the screen and pop the door open? I said, oh, yeah, that's how it happened. I'm thinking, if I just tell them what they want to hear, I'm going to get a lawyer. I'm going to prove my innocence, because there's not going to be any blood there. There's not going to be any fingerprints there. There's not going to be anything there to prove that I committed this crime, because I was never there.
Yeah, you just wanted to tell them what they wanted to hear so that you would get out of the room.
Well, after I got in the house, they said, what'd you do? I just said, I raped a woman, just to get this over with. No, they go, no. What did you do before that? Didn't you go into the kitchen? I said, oh, yeah. I went to the kitchen. They said, what'd you do after that? Didn't you get another knife or something, or pick up something sharp? I said, yeah, I think I did. He goes, then what'd you do? And I just said, I raped a woman. And he goes, no. He goes, what did you do after that? I said, I went upstairs. Well, apparently this house didn't have stairs. It was just a hallway. And they said, well, no, didn't you go down the hallway? I said, oh, yeah, I went down the hallway, that's right.
What Eddie is describing is a classic example of interrogators using leading questions to direct a suspect into confirming what they already know. A true and reliable confession should provide the investigators with information not already known to the police, and which the suspect couldn't know unless they were involved. In this case, Eddie is not only not providing information unknown to the police, he's actively getting details wrong, and is being coached in his compliant state into telling a story that fits with what investigators already know.
And then what'd you do? I said, I raped a woman. They said, no, we want to know specifically what you did. She says, you jumped on that woman, didn't you? I said, yeah. And he goes, well, what was she wearing? And I said, pajamas. And they go, no, wasn't she just wearing a night skirt, a night shirt and her underwear underneath? I said, I think that's what she was wearing. And they said, what'd you hit her with? Because you hit her with something, because she had a cut on her forehead. And I said, I hit her with a lamp. And they said, no, you didn't. You hit her with the butt of that knife, didn't you? I said, oh, yeah, that's what happened. And then they said, what'd you do then? I said, I raped her. And they go, well, what'd you do after that? I said, I ran out to my car and I left. You know, there's probably some more details in there that I can't remember, because, you know, that part went on for quite a while, because I was pausing and thinking and, you know, and crying and just, you know, not sure what to do. I know that it was stupid for me to do that now, but at that time I was in such an emotional state. I was looking for an escape hatch.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted out of that interrogation. I didn't want to be there anymore. And then at the very end, they go, do you mind saying all this over again into a videotape? or audio tape into this tape recorder. I said, no, I'm not saying nothing. And then they go, okay, we're arresting you for rape, aggravated burglary, and aggravated assault.
Mm-hmm.
After they arrested me and took blood and all that stuff and put me in jail, and I finally got a court-appointed lawyer, I recanted my confession. I was telling my lawyer about what happened and everything. And of course, at the preliminary hearing, the judge allowed the confession in, and you know, he didn't throw it out.
He said that it was voluntary.
My interrogation was not videotaped and it was not audio taped. And if it had been audio taped and videotaped, I probably wouldn't be sitting here telling you this story, because they would have heard what I said compared to what they said during this interrogation. They told the jury that, you know, that I calmly and collectively gave them intimate details that only the perpetrator knew. And that was the only evidence, because I took the stand and I tried to defend myself and tell them why I said all that stuff. I had two jury trials. The first one ended up in a hung jury, because I think my lawyer had told me that a professor or someone that was on the jury that maybe had some dealings with false confessions. And I was told that he hung this jury. And then the next time that I had the jury trial, one thing I did notice was there were a lot older jurors. I don't know if that had anything to do with it or what, but again, I took the witness stand. And I told them my story, you know, about, you know, how the confession happened and all that stuff. But without audio tape or videotape, it was their word against my word. And the real perpetrator who committed this crime had O positive blood. And that's the only other thing. I have O positive blood.
38% of the population has O positive blood. But that, along with Eddie's confession, was enough to secure a conviction.
And I got found guilty and sentenced to 13 to life.
Eddie Lowry spent 9 years in prison for a crime he did not commit before he was paroled in 1991, free, but with a lifetime sentence to register as a sex offender. He doggedly sought to clear his name. With his own money, he hired an attorney, and finally, in 2002, he was able to get DNA testing done on evidence that was never tested. This is another problem with false confessions. Once obtained, investigators often forego examining crucial evidence because the confession is sufficient and such evidence may only undermine it. When the bedding, portions of the victim's nightgown, and vaginal swabs from the rape kit were finally tested, Eddie was excluded as a contributor. The District Court of Riley County, Kansas, vacated his conviction in 2003. Eddie filed a federal civil rights lawsuit and settled the case in 2010 for $7.5 million. The DNA eventually led authorities to Daniel Brewer. And in 2011, he pled guilty to the rape Eddie was convicted of, as well as another rape committed around the same time. All of this could have been avoided if the police hadn't pressured Eddie Lowry to falsely confess.
Eddie's story exemplifies the most common form of false confessions, compliant confessions. But beyond this, there's an even more psychologically disturbing phenomenon, the internalized false confession, where an innocent suspect comes to believe, if only for long enough to sign a statement, that they may actually be guilty.
They really mess with your head, you know. I'm thinking, even at one point, I'm thinking in my head, did I really commit this crime? Did I just kind of black it out or something?
Stay tuned for the next episode of False Confessions. What if I did it?
In the meantime, get lost with us. Find us on Blue Sky at amandanox.com.
At wisecracker.bsky.social.
On Instagram at amamanox.
At mccarbon.
You can learn more about our work and how to support it at amandanox.com. And we know you said you already left a 5-star review for Labyrinths, but this polygraph says otherwise.
False Confessions, a Labyrinths miniseries, is brought to you by Knox Robinson Productions. This episode was written and produced by us, along with our managing producer, Andre Sapp, and our production assistant, Charlie Darnell. Our theme music is by Josh Budo Karp.